All right. Thanks, guys. Tonight, we're going to finish up our series on vision. This is week 10. So we're at the end. How about that? Yeah. All right. So much excitement. You just wanted to keep going, right? That's why you weren't cheering. So here's the deal. If you've not been here, if you're somewhat new, we've been in this 10-week series where we've been talking about vision. And we've been looking at this story of this guy named Nehemiah. And just to give you a snapshot of what it's about, on your way out, check out the pictures that are out in the foyer. There's a table out there with a bunch of pictures on them, on the table. And those pictures represent some of the visions of people in our community. People who have emailed us over the past several weeks and said, here's a vision that I think God has given me. Here's what it's about. Here's kind of a picture. And there's some descriptions up out there as well. So check those out on your way out, because we really do believe God has a vision for each one of our lives. And he's got a big picture, long-term vision, but he's even got like very specific visions of what he wants to do in you and through you over the next few months or maybe even the next few years of your life. And so we've been talking about that, and we're going to wrap that up tonight. But before we jump back into Nehemiah, I want to ask you a few questions. And the first question is this: how many of you have a musical instrument laying around in your house that you never use anymore? Like one of these under the bed? Anybody got one of these? Like anybody? Yes, I see that hand. Yes, we're taking count. No. How many? If you, clarinet, oboe in the closet from your band days? Anybody started like drums in the garage that you don't play anymore? They're covered up. They're collecting dust. We've all been there. Let me ask another one. How many of you have an appliance in your kitchen that you bought at some point? This is a juicer. How many of you saw the documentary and you got excited about juicing? And you went out and you bought the juicer or the Vitamix blender. Or at some point in your life, you got a George Foreman grill. Remember those? Because you got so excited about the new way to like cook meat. And you got this blender, you got this appliance, and now it's just collecting dust in your pantry or in your closet somewhere. Here's another question. How many of you have an exercise machine somewhere in your house? We thought about bringing a treadmill up here, but that would have been a little difficult. How many have a treadmill, an elliptical, like Bowflex? Is that the name of it? Like one of those deals, like, or some sort of exercise machine. You got excited about it and you went out and got the thing because it was on sale and you were going to get into it, and you did it for a few weeks and that's about it. Or you have a gym membership. I won't ask for a raise of hands, but just think about that. How many of us have a gym membership that we're paying, where if you showed up at the gym today, nobody would recognize you because you haven't been there in a long, long time? Or how about this one? How many of you have ever started a blog? You started a blog, you got this idea, you were going to share all your amazing ideas with the world because they're amazing and everyone wants to know. And you just started this blog and you were going, but you haven't updated it since like 2011, you know, one of those things. Or how about this? Home projects. There's another one. For those of us who own homes, how many have started a home project where if I came over to your house, like you started a couple of years ago and the paint cans are still laying there or the tools are still on the floor and it's just halfway done because you started it and you got all excited and then you just decided I'll finish it later. You've just never gotten around to finishing it. I ask all those questions because as I think about my own life, I realize something about myself. It's easy to start things like that. It's really easy to start things, but it's really difficult to finish things. And the reason is because it just doesn't take a lot to get us started. I'm guessing you're the same way. I mean, we can get started on something new in our lives for a bunch of reasons. We can see a commercial on TV that gets us excited about doing something new. We can see a sale down at the store. Wow, the treadmill's like 25% off. We need to buy this, you know? We can see a movie that inspires us, right? Backdraft. Do you remember? Anybody remember Backdraft? I wanted to be a fireman after Backdraft. That's before most of your time, but Matt remembers Backdraft, right? Yes. So you can see a movie. You can read a great book. You can hear a great sermon. There can be something that you see or that you experience that gets you excited about starting something new in your life. But here's the deal. Those experiences or those things or the song you hear or an encouragement from a friend, right? A friend says, you know, go for it. You can do it. Those things don't have what it takes to help us actually finish what we start. And again, we're really good at starting. We can start all kinds of things. Anybody in here could start a new business this week. You could start and launch a new business. So you could start writing a book, right? You could just, even if you feel like you have no talent whatsoever, you could start writing a book. You could start training for a marathon. You could even start running a marathon. Every single person in this room could start running a marathon. We could all do it. Now, finishing the marathon is a different story because it's just hard to oftentimes finish the things we start. And the reason is because, again, the things that get us started, whatever motivates us or inspires us or compels us to do something new in our lives, it's almost like a starting block for a track runner. You know, there's a starting block that launches you off, but it doesn't, whatever it is that gets us inspired to start something doesn't have what it takes, doesn't have the power or endurance to help us necessarily finish it. Now, the truth is, this is similar to our spiritual lives as well. Because we all start things all the time in our spiritual lives. We make those promises to God about all kinds of new things we're going to start doing, right? Have you ever made these kind of promises? God, I'm going to start praying every single day. Like something in your life convicts you or moves you, and you just decide, I'm going to start praying every day. Or God, I'm going to start getting up early every morning because Jesus got up early in the morning, right? Jesus was a morning person. We all know that. And he got up early and he read the Bible. You know, I'm going to start getting up early and reading the Bible every single day. Or you become convicted or challenged about sharing your faith. And so you make this promise, like, I'm going to go to work tomorrow and I'm going to start sharing my faith at work, God. Or I'm going to start going to church every week. I just kind of go once every couple of months. But I'm really going to start going every week. Or I'm going to start getting involved in church. I'm not going to just go on Sundays. I'm going to actually start meeting people and doing other things. Or I'm going to start changing the way I see my relationship. We make all kinds of promises to God all the time about new things that we're going to start doing in our lives. And we get so excited, and some of it's because we hear a sermon or we read a book or somebody inspires us or motivates us or challenges us or convicts us. And so we launch out, we make these promises to God. And then what happens? A couple weeks, a couple months goes by, and we just fall right back into the same habits and the patterns we had before. Nothing really changes long term. And why is that? Is it because our intentions were wrong in the beginning? I don't think so. I mean, our intentions are in the right place. We're motivated. Something happens, and I think it's the Holy Spirit. Like, I think God, through his Holy Spirit, somehow moves in our lives, and he challenges us and convicts us. And we feel that. We have this experience with God. It can be at church. It can be in a worship service. It can be in all kinds of different ways. But we'll have a genuine experience with God, and it'll motivate us to try some new things or do some new things or make some challenges. But the problem is the experience itself, the emotions themselves, when we felt them early on and they inspired us to make changes, aren't enough to help us finish. Well, it's really easy to get started. It's really hard to finish. It's like we need something else beyond the experience that motivates us in the beginning. We need something else to help us keep going. Now, I say all that because that's actually the situation that the people of Judah found themselves in Nehemiah's time. So we've been reading this story about this guy named Nehemiah. And you remember he lived in Persia. And there was no Israel anymore. The nation of Israel had been destroyed, and the people had mostly been exiled. Some people had moved back to Jerusalem. The walls around Jerusalem were in ruins. The city was kind of in ruins. There were just a few people that lived in this province of Judah. And Nehemiah got this vision. It was a specific vision to move back to Jerusalem and help the people rebuild the walls around their city. And so he goes back, and remember, he casts a vision to all the people, and they get all excited, and they start going to work, and all the other people around them, all the other nations and cultures said, there's no way they can do that. They're a bunch of lazy, you know, they'll never finish, they'll never get this done. They don't know what they're doing, they're incompetent, all those things. And they finished it. Like, they pulled it off, they accomplished the vision. In 52 days, they built this huge wall around their city. And God used it because all the people around them went, whoa. Like, there's no way they could have done that on their own. Their God must have helped them. And then they started believing that too. Like, there's no way we could have pulled this off. God must have intervened. And then remember, they had this huge worship service because they fell down on their faces and they started worshiping God because he showed up. Like, he showed up in their lives and he showed up through this vision. And so they started worshiping God and God starts transforming their community. And then they start realizing that God has moved in their community and he's restoring the whole community. That the broken down walls were just symbolic of their broken down lives. And they realized they had been so far away from God that their whole community had strayed so far and had abandoned God in so many ways, in so many different areas of their lives, that it just led to this broken down existence. But God had helped them in rebuilding this wall, and in doing so, God was helping them rebuild their lives and their community. So they had this big worship service. God moves. They had this huge emotional experience. Like, it's like Friday night of youth camp, you know? Like, they're like making all kinds of promises. They're going to go home and change their lives and everything's going to be different. And so they make all these promises. In fact, Nehemiah even says, let's put them in writing. Like, if we're going to do this, if we're really going to change our lives and do some new things in our lives, let's put it in writing. And so look at this. It says this in Nehemiah chapter 9, verse 38. In view of all this, in view of the summary I just gave you, everything that happened, we are making a binding agreement, putting it in writing, and our leaders, our Levites, and our priests are affixing their seals to it. So they make this contract. I mean, you and I make promises to God. They actually wrote it down. Like, we are going to write down these promises and this contract that we're making with you, God. And they actually make three really important promises. We're not going to go back and reread the verses. I'll just tell you the promises they made. The first, and we looked a little bit at this last week, is they said, promise number one, we will not intermarry with the peoples around us. Now, this seems a little strange to us. And the issue here is not racism or prejudice. It's not that they had something against the other races or the other ethnicities. They were just trying to follow God's law. Because hundreds of years before, when the Israelites went into the promised land, God said to them, don't intermarry with all the other people around you that are living there. Because here's what's going to happen. All those other people worship other idols, and they worship other gods, and they have totally different practices all dedicated to that. And if you start intermarrying with them, their cultures and their customs and their worship of their other gods and idols will infiltrate your culture. You won't be able to withstand it. And it's going to change, and you're going to start abandoning your worship of me. And sure enough, that's what happened to Israel. And that's part of the reason that their community fell apart. It's part of the reason their whole nation fell apart. And so here in Nehemiah's time, the people realize this. And they realize this was part of the problem that our ancestors and we have been doing. And so we're not going to do it anymore, God. We're not going to intermarry with any of the people around us. They made another promise, second promise. We will keep the Sabbath and the holidays. So essentially, God had also told the people of Israel in the law, I want you to set aside one day a week where you don't do any work. I know you think you've got more work than you can get done in 6 days, but you got to trust me. If you can set aside one day where you don't do any work, it'll be showing the way that you trust in my provision for you. It'll also provide you rest. I just want you to rest one day a week. And I want you to seek me and spend time with me on that day. And I'm also going to set aside some specific holidays throughout the whole year where you can rest and spend time with me. And that way you'll show me your trust and you'll worship me and you'll be drawn to me. And so what that means practically is take that day off. Take those holidays off. Don't do any trade. Don't go to the store. Don't work. Don't check your email. Like, don't do all these things. I want you to just rest and spend time with me. But sure enough, the Israelites eventually stopped doing that. They stopped celebrating the Sabbath day. They stopped celebrating all of the holidays. They were doing trade. They were treating every single day, like every single Sabbath day or holiday, like all the other days. All the other nations and all the people would bring in their bread and their wine and their grapes and all of their stuff they were wanting to trade. And it just became like another market day in the week. And so the people make this promise here. Okay, God, we realize where that led us before. We realize that it changed our culture because we just started acting like all the other cultures around us. And so we're making a promise. We're going to start keeping the Sabbath again. And we're going to start keeping all of the holidays again. They make a third promise. Promise number three, we will give to support the temple worship. So what happened was, over the years, the people would give their allotted portion every single week or every single month or every single year to pay for all of the worship that took place at the temple. But eventually they stopped doing that. And when they stopped doing that, the priests and the Levites who were paid, who got their income from the gifts and the offerings of all the other people, didn't have any income anymore. And so the priests and the Levites just left their role and they went back to their farms and their fields because that was the only way they could make income. And so the people stopped worshiping at the temple. There weren't any priests and Levites there. There were no donations for sacrifices. Nobody was giving wood for the sacrifices to actually happen. Nobody was giving grain and animals and all these other things. And the people just stopped giving to support the worship. And partly it was because it just wasn't important to them. It wasn't important. And in fact, Jesus would say a long time later, he would say, "You want to know what's important to you? Just look at what you spend your money on and give your money to. That'll show you what's important to you." And for the people, the worship of the community wasn't important. And so they stopped giving their money to that. And in this point in Nehemiah's story, the people realized that's what pulled us away from God. So we're not going to let that happen again, God. And they make all these specific promises. They say, we're going to start giving money. We're going to start tithing. That's a portion of our money we're going to give to the temple worship. We're going to make sure the priests and the Levites and the worship leaders get paid so they can lead us in worship. We're going to bring grain. We're going to set up appointed times for different families to bring firewood. Like, they get really specific because, God, we're not going to neglect this anymore. We're going to give to make sure the temple worship keeps going on. So these were their three promises. Basically, in our relationships, in the way we spend our time, and in the way we spend our money, we're going to make some significant changes, God. We're not going to go back to the way we used to do things. We've gotten a vision from you, and you showed up in our midst, and we had this amazing experience. And it's changed us so much that we don't want to go back to the way we used to live. We're making some new changes and a new start in our life. So they make these promises. And then guess what happens? Nehemiah, you remember he's from Persia. And when he first comes down to Jerusalem, he has to get permission from the king. That's who he worked for. And the king actually said before he left, "Hey, give me a time frame. How long are you going to be gone?" So Nehemiah had to give him a time frame. So then Nehemiah comes down. He helps them rebuild the wall. He helps them institute all these changes in their culture. And they even make him governor because he's a really good leader and he's a really good administrator and he's good at organizing things. And so he becomes governor of the province and he stays there for 12 years. And yet when 12 years has passed, he realizes his time has come and he needs to go back to Persia to work for the king there. And so when he leaves, everything is in order. The people have made these promises. They're keeping the Sabbath. They're keeping the holidays. They're keeping all the holidays, the Feast of Booths and the Feast of Passover and all these things. They're given money. The temple worship is happening. Sacrifices, everything. They're not intermarrying. Everything is going well. And so then Nehemiah leaves. And he goes back to Persia. And we don't know how long he was gone. It could have been weeks. It could have been a few months. It might have been a year or two. But Nehemiah comes back to Judah after being gone for a little while, and everyone has abandoned all the promises that they made. They've all slipped into living according to the same old habits and the same old patterns that they had before. Even though all of those habits and patterns, they came to the realization that those are the things that broke and destroyed our community to begin with. Those are the things that God has changed us. Those are the things that God gave us a vision and an inspiration and this emotional, passionate worship service that we all had. We were all there. We experienced it. And we made all these promises. And Nehemiah leaves for a little while. And he comes back. And they've gone back to doing all the same things they were doing before. When he gets back, the men have intermarried with a bunch of foreign women, and their other cultures are starting to infiltrate their culture once again. All the merchants and traders have come back into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day, and they're not keeping the Sabbath or any of the holidays. He gets back, and the temple doors are like closed and locked, and nobody's there. In fact, they're using it for storage. They've given it to this guy who started storing his stuff in there. That's a guy that they didn't really like to begin with. But he's kind of infiltrated his way in, and he's just storing his stuff there. And they're not, and the priests and the Levites are gone because they didn't have any money because nobody was paying them. And so they just went back to their fields, and they started trying to earn a living that way. And think about this for a second. If you're Nehemiah, and you've given your entire life to these people, or at least 12 years of your life to these people, and you've poured into them, and you've led them, and you've shepherded them, and they made all of these promises to God, and they made all of these promises to you, and you leave for a little while, and you come back, and they've broken all of them, and they've gone back on everything they said they would do. How mad, how angry, how upset, how discouraged and disappointed do you think Nehemiah was? Look at what he does when he gets back. We're going to read a few verses from chapter 13. This is what it says in chapter 13, verse 7. This is how Nehemiah describes it. I came back to Jerusalem, and here I learned about the evil thing Eliashib, that was the high priest in the temple, had done in providing Tobiah a room in the courts of the house of God. I was greatly displeased, and I threw all of Tobiah's household goods out of the room. I gave orders to purify the rooms, and then I put back into them the equipment of the house of God with the grain offerings and the incense. I also learned that the portions assigned to the Levites had not been given to them, and that all the Levites and musicians responsible for the service had gone back to their own fields. And so I rebuked the officials, and I asked them, "Why is the house of God neglected?" And then I called them together, and I stationed them at their posts. So he gets back, and he sees what's going on in the temple, and he sees it's just being used for storage, and nobody's worshiping there anymore. None of the gifts are being brought. Nobody's getting paid, and he's so mad that he throws this guy's stuff out. He throws him out, and he starts rebuking the officials. Look at what else he does. Verse 15. The Sabbath rolls around, and it says this: "In those days, I saw people in Judah treading wine presses on the Sabbath." That means they were doing work. "And they were bringing in grain, and they were loading it on donkeys, together with wine and grapes and figs and all other kinds of loads. And they were bringing all this into Jerusalem on the Sabbath. Therefore, I warned them against selling food on that day. But people from Tyre who lived in Jerusalem were bringing in fish and all kinds of merchandise and selling them in Jerusalem on the Sabbath to the people of Judah. I rebuked the nobles of Judah, and I said to them, 'What is this wicked thing you are doing, desecrating the Sabbath day? Didn't your ancestors do the same things so that our God brought all this calamity on us and on the city? And now you're stirring up more wrath against Israel by desecrating the Sabbath.'" So that's a lot to read, and there's like fish and grapes and figs and all kinds of stuff going on. But basically, Nehemiah gets the point. He goes, "Don't you get it? Don't you realize what you're doing now is, that's the very reason that our community fell apart in the first place. I know it seems small and minor to you, but it's not. It's a big deal." He goes on, look at this, verse 19. "When evening shadows fell on the gates of Jerusalem before the Sabbath, I ordered the doors to be shut and not opened until the Sabbath was over. I stationed some of my own men at the gates so that no load could be brought in on the Sabbath day. Once or twice, the merchants and sellers of all kinds of goods spent the night outside Jerusalem, but I warned them and I said, 'Why do you spend the night by the wall? If you do this again, I will arrest you.' And from that time on, they no longer came on the Sabbath. And then I commanded the Levites to purify themselves and go and guard the gates in order to keep the Sabbath day holy." So Nehemiah's, he's starting to get pretty angry, and he's starting to take action. And so he's posting guards. He's closing the doors. He's not going to let anyone come in on the Sabbath. And then when some of the traders are sleeping outside the wall, they're waiting to try to get in, he gets so upset and he says, "Look, if you do that again," and the literal Hebrew says, "I will lay hands on you." It's translated, "I will arrest you," because that's probably what it meant. But he's basically saying, "If you do that again, I'm getting physical. Like, this is, I'm not like going to be Mr. Nice Guy anymore. I'll lay hands on you. I will arrest you. I'll do whatever it takes." And so he's starting to get serious with these people about what they've been doing. He doesn't stop there. Look at what happens when he finds out about the intermarriage.
Verse 23. Moreover, in those days I saw men of Judah who had married women from Ashdod, from Ammon, and from Moab. Half of their children spoke the language of Ashdod or the language of one of the other peoples, and they didn't even know how to speak the language of Judah. So I rebuked them, and I called curses down on them. I beat some of the men and pulled out their hair, and I made them take an oath in God's name. So Nehemiah is so frustrated. When he sees what's going on, he sees how the other cultures have implemented, he sees what the people, he's so frustrated that he starts grabbing guys, and you can almost picture he like grabs a dude and he's like, what are you doing? Like he just starts, he's pulling out their hair and he's calling down curses and beating them up. I was talking to Dan earlier this week, and Dan said he was so inspired by this that he's going to start implementing some of Nehemiah's methods in his own pastoral shepherding. So you might want to stay away from Dan from now on, lest he beat you up or pull your hair out. But here's the deal. You can imagine, as Nehemiah is doing this, that some of these guys are going, what's the big deal? So what? I married somebody I fell in love with. Like, what's the big deal with that? So we bought some bread on the Sabbath. So the priest didn't have enough money and they had to get other jobs. Like, what's the big deal, Nehemiah? And you can almost picture Nehemiah going, but you don't get it. It is a big deal. Because when you start getting careless in all of these little things, and you start getting careless in all of these things that you've promised, it jeopardizes not only you, but it jeopardizes the entire community. Because every single one of these little things, I know the Sabbath may not seem like a big deal to you. I know that giving may not seem like a big deal. I know that even intermarriage may not seem like it's related at all to your relationship with God. But it is. All of these things speak to the bigger issue of whether you trust God or not. And it's not like God gave us these laws and they're just arbitrary. It's not like God just said, hey, I'm just going to try to think of some rules so that they can't have any fun. And I'm just going to put them all in place and tell them they got to obey. It's not like that at all. God has such a bigger perspective on this. God sees where these things lead in our lives. And that's why he told us not to do these things. And so the issue comes down to whether we trust him or not in our relationships, in our time, in our finances. Do we trust God? Are we going to live the kind of life he's called us to live? And Nehemiah sees that the people aren't doing it, and he sees the bigger perspective, even though they don't. And it makes him so frustrated and so mad that he's grabbing guys and he's beating them up and he's pulling out their hair to try to show them, to try to shake them out of their complacency. Look at how it ends. This is verse 30. This is what Nehemiah says. This is his memoirs. He says, so I purified the priests and the Levites of everything foreign, and I assigned them duties, each to his own task. I also made provision for contributions of wood at designated times and for the first fruits. Then he just says, remember me with favor, my God. It's almost as if he's saying, I left for a little while, everything fell apart, I've come back, God, I'm trying to put it back in place, I'm doing the best I can. It's not perfect, we're not perfect, but just remember me and what I'm doing, show your grace and your favor upon me. And that's how the book of Nehemiah ends. Now, I think there's two really, really important lessons we can learn from this story tonight. And the first is this. Number one, vision leaks. Vision leaks. No matter what God has done for you, in you, or around you, you and I have the potential to drift away from him. The vision leaks. It's like water in a bucket that's got little holes in the bottom. And eventually it leaks out. And unless you're constantly refilling that bucket with a vision of who you are and whose you are and what God wants to do in you and through you, it's just going to leak its way out of your life.
And even when we think, God has done so much for me and he's changed me and I have these great experiences with him and we're so tight and he saved me and he's rescued me and I would never drift away from him. We've got to come to a place where we realize that's the gravity of life. Vision's always going to leak and we will always be in danger of drifting away from him. And if we don't think we are, then we're naive. Because this story illustrates in a really powerful way, nobody's immune from drifting. I mean, God showed up. He helped them build this wall and they got reestablished. And they had the most amazing worship service you could ever have. We've read that over the last couple of weeks. Like, God had moved in the most supernatural way in their midst. And they made all their promises to God and they still drifted away from him. Because an experience of God living out vision in your life isn't enough to ensure that you don't drift away from him. It's like the starting block that launches the runner out. It's enough to get you started. It's enough to get you motivated and inspired. It's enough for you to come to the place where you'll make some great promises of new things you're going to do for God. But it's just not enough to keep us from drifting away. Nobody's immune from drifting. Doesn't matter how long you've been a Christian. Maybe you're here tonight and you've been a Christian for 30 years of your life. You're still in danger of drifting. Doesn't matter how much of the Bible you know. You maybe have read the Bible 10 times. You can like just recite verses left and right. You're still in danger of drifting. I'm still in danger of drifting. It doesn't matter how much theology you know. It doesn't even matter what you believe in your head. You're still in danger of drifting away from him in your relationships, in my relationships, in our time, and even in the way we manage our finances. And so we have to come face to face with a reality tonight. And the reality is this. Every single person in this room is in one of two positions right now. You are either currently drifting away from God or you're in danger of drifting away from God. You're either currently drifting away from God or you're in danger of drifting away from God. And the vision of who we are and who God has called us to be, the vision is always going to leak. And unless we're refilling it up and unless we recognize the danger that we're in, then it's possible we could drift away from him. So the big question is, what do we do about that? How do we ensure that we don't drift? Well, that's the second lesson I think we learn in this story, and it's this. Number two, maintaining your vision and your faithfulness requires two things. Clear standards and bold leadership. Clear standards and bold leadership. For starters, we need clear standards. Nehemiah was smart. He didn't just ride the wave of this emotional revival worship service and just say, yeah, this is awesome, God is awesome, and we're going to start being awesome. Like, that's just too general and too vague. And so he put in place some really clear standards for the people of Judah. He said, we've got to define some core values and some core practices of how we live out our lives and what our faith looks like. And we got to get really specific about this. We've got to ensure that we don't backslide or go back into the ways we used to do. We've got to get super specific. So here's the deal. We're going to make promises. We're going to talk about our relationships and what those look like every day. We're going to talk about how we spend our time. We're going to talk about how we give our money. And we're going to get so specific that we're going to start like making a list. Like, this family gives firewood, like four cords on this month. And this family brings grain on this month. Because unless you're specific, and unless you're clear, and unless you have these standards in place, and you'll just slip right back into your former ways. But if you have standards in place, Nehemiah can show up and he can say, hey, have you intermarried? Like, that's a yes or no question. Like, there's no, like, kind of, well, not sure, well, we're working on that. Like, no, either you have or you haven't. Have you kept the Sabbath? Like, either you have or you haven't. Have you given the wood that was allotted to your family this month? Either you did or you didn't. They knew. And Nehemiah knew they needed some clear standards in place. And I think that's true of us as well. Now, there's a temptation for some of us here. You might be here tonight and you grew up in a legalistic home. Or you grew up in a legalistic church or religious setting where there were so many rules and so many hoops that you had to jump through, and you've come to a place in your life where you're like, I am never going back to that again. Like, I'm a Christian now, and I'm free, and we are not bound by rules and the law. Like, Jesus set us free from that, and so we're not bound by any of those things anymore. That's true. We're not. But if you want to ensure that you don't drift away from Him, and if I want to ensure that, we got to have some clear standards in our life. Standards not so that we just have a checklist, so we get up every morning like, yeah, did that. Standards not so that we can say, look at all the things I'm doing for you, God, and earning His favor, not because of that, but standards because we ultimately just want to trust in Him and worship Him and be used by Him to be a light to all the other people around us. But if we're going to be that kind of people, we need some clear standards in place in our lives, or else we're always going to be susceptible to drifting away from who He's called us to be. Now, here's the deal. We need clear standards, but we also need bold leadership. Because the people of Judah had clear standards. But the minute Nehemiah left, they went right back into doing all the things they did before. They needed bold leadership like you and I need. And so we need somebody in our lives, and it can be a friend. It can be an accountability group. It can be a pastor. It can be a leader. It can be one or two other people that are standing there and watching us and helping us. And they're like a Nehemiah in our lives. They're basically standing there with a couple of flags in their hand, and they're waving those flags anytime we begin to cross the lines or the standards or compromise what we feel like God has called us to be, and say, hey, whoa, you said, you made these promises. I know you. This is the kind of character you want to have, but I see you drifting away from that. We need people like that in our lives. We need Nehemiahs in our lives who, when we start drifting past those lines, they'll come in and beat us up a little bit. Like, literally, they will get physical with us and start pulling out here and say, dude, you cannot do this. This is not you. This is not who God has called you to be. We need that kind of bold leadership in our lives. I want to tell you a story to kind of wrap things up. I grew up in North Carolina, a couple hours from the beach. And every summer, I would travel down with my friend Brian McNamara and his family, and we'd go down to Hilton Head, which is in South Carolina, which is right on the beach. And they would rent a condo, and we would be there for a week. And we would just spend every single day out in the ocean. We'd go out in the ocean, and we'd swim, and we'd body surf, and do all those kind of things. And if you grew up like near the beach or going to the beach, you know how this works. You go out in the ocean, you're out swimming, you're having fun, you're doing all kinds of stuff, and you don't realize how subtle the current is. You don't realize how subtle the undertow is. And you're out there playing, and it's like every single time you pick your legs up from the ground just a little bit and you're riding waves, stuff like that, it's like the current and the undertow moves you a little bit farther down the beach. And after you've been doing this for like 30 minutes or an hour, it's like you finally look up back at the beach and you're like, whoa, who moved the condo way down there? And you realize like the condo didn't move. I moved. I'm the one, because I've just been drifting this entire time and I didn't even notice it. And the way to ensure that I don't drift is if there's an immovable object on the beach, there's a landmark, there's something on the beach which I can measure myself by so that I can look up constantly and realize that I'm right there. And if I get too far down or I get too far away, then I can realize I need to get out of the water and walk back down to get back to where I need to be. Or better yet, we need not just an immovable object on the beach, we need somebody else on the beach looking out for us. Like a lifeguard or a friend who's got those flags in their hand. And so anytime we get too far away, it's like they're waving and saying, you're too far down. You've gotten too far out. You're in danger. You need to come back in and be where you're supposed to be. And that's the reality of our lives. That's the danger of drifting in our lives. And here's the truth tonight. I pray that God would give us some big, bold, exciting visions. I pray he's done that for the last 10 weeks. I pray that we'll keep thinking about that and praying for that. And when he does, it's almost like God is sending us out into the ocean. And there's going to be waves, and we're going to get tossed. And sometimes it's going to be really challenging, but we'll have to trust in him. And it's like he's sending us out into the ocean. But we dare not go out into the ocean and live out the visions he gives us unless we have some clear standards, unless we have something on the beach by which we can measure ourselves against, and unless we have somebody in our lives who's standing there when we get tossed around and we get in danger zones who can say, whoa, you need to come back. You've drifted too far away. God's going to give you vision. He's going to give me vision. But we need the standards and we need the bold leadership. And so maybe the question to close with tonight is, do you have that in your life? Have you set up some clear standards? This is how I'm going to approach my relationships. This is how I'm going to spend my time. This is how I'm going to spend my finances. I mean, there's lots of areas we can talk about, but I think those are probably the three biggest. Do you have those kind of clear standards? And then do you have a Nehemiah in your life? And if you don't, you need to get one. And if you have no idea how, come talk to me. I'll tell you how I've tried to find that in my life. I'll tell you how I've tried to set some standards, or talk to Dan or Stephen or one of the other pastors or Alyssa or one of the other leaders in our church, and we'll try to help you figure out how do you find some standards and how do you find that kind of leadership in our lives. But we've got to do it because it's too important for us to launch off and start things if we haven't thought about how we can finish them well, not just for our sake, partly so, but for God's sake and the vision's sake that he wants to give each one of us. Let me pray, and then we'll close by singing together. Father God, I pray that if there's anyone here tonight who feels convicted, maybe feels like they have drifted, or they're in the process of drifting, or they're just a long ways away, I pray you give them the courage and the boldness to take some big steps of faith. If that means getting out of the water and running back to you, whatever that looks like, I pray that you would help them do that. And if we can help them as a community do that, we've all been there, we all know what that's like, and it's like it's a process that it's always happening in each one of our lives. It's running back to you. And so help us to do that together as a community of faith. And help us not to feel condemnation. Help us not to feel guilt. Help us to know that you're like the Father standing on the porch waiting for someone to come home so you can celebrate that. And Father God, in the same token, as we pray for vision in our lives, God, I pray you would give us big and bold visions. And I pray that as we go out into the ocean, you'd help us to trust in you. You'd help us to look to you. You'd help us to keep our eyes and our focus on you. Because you'll hold us up and you'll keep us in your grasp. And you do want to do significant and bold things through each one of us. We pray this in your name. Amen.